And as I was saying, tonight on the show, we are interviewing Bernice Sire and Judith Harris. They are cooperative researchers and community development leaders from the University of Winnipeg. Their paper, Social Services and the Co-op Option for Indigenous Communities, outlines a strategy for effective delivery of social services through the use of social and solidarity co-ops. Judith Harris has been active in community development in urban and rural Ontario and Manitoba in international contexts as well for about 30 years. And she is an instructor with the Department of Urban and Inner City Studies at the University of Winnipeg. Bernice Sire is a dynamic leader with over 20 years of successful experience in the senior financial and executive positions in nonprofits, social services, and economic development sectors. She is an instructor and former executive director of the Métis Child and Family Services, as well as the Native Women's Transition Center. Tonight, we'll be really discussing the topic of their paper, Social Services and the Co-op Option for Indigenous Communities. And we'll be covering a lot of topics. We start in the next section talking about incarceration and reintegration for women in Manitoba. And we get into the topic of social impact bonds, a new way of funding social services through a cooperative model. As well, we'll be discussing child and family services within Winnipeg. I would really encourage you to listen to the really interesting and innovative models that we'll be discussing with respect to applying social services through a cooperative lens. Some really interesting cutting edge stuff here. And I hope you enjoy tonight's interview with Bernice Sire and Judith Harris from the University of Winnipeg. You're, of course, listening to Vancouver Co-op Radio. This is CFRO 100.5 FM in Vancouver, and you can always listen live online at cooperadio.org.
For all the cooperative connection, today we're speaking with Judith Harris and Bernice Sire. They are cooperative researchers in cooperative studies, and we've been connected with them through the Canadian Association for Studies in Cooperation, or CASC. They're working on an interesting project about social services co-ops and connections for Indigenous communities. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So I did want to get into your paper, but I also was just very curious how your connection came together, because I understand you're both from different backgrounds. Judith, you're in the Department of Urban and Inner City Studies at the University of Winnipeg, and Bernice, you're the former ED of the Métis Child and Family Services and Native Women's Transition Center.
Yes, I was the CEO of the Child Welfare System for Métis and Inuit here in Manitoba.
And how did you come to connect over cooperatives?
Well, we were talking at the university. I had gone to Italy and seen some prison co-ops with Anne Hoyt from University of Wisconsin-Madison. And so I was encouraged by a few people, Larry Morissette from OPK in Winnipeg, a gang transition group. And he had said, let's bring this here to Winnipeg. So we had a search conference about these ideas and bringing a social co-op to Winnipeg for women transitioning from prison. And Bernice was aware of what we were doing. She invited some of us to come to Eagle Women's Lodge, a new center where women transition from prison. And she thought, co-op, yes, that would be great for these women. Maybe a sewing co-op, maybe possibly a hospitality co-op, catering co-op. So this is how I met up. Bernice had been teaching at our Urban and Inner City Studies program on financial management. So this is where the two of us came together.
Neat.
It was just a natural fit. We were trying to figure out a way to decarcerate women coming out of provincial corrections, because there's no no system of decarceration. There's no way of women just aside from being released, and then we have this astronomical recidivism rate, right? Mm. So it was just an opportunity to start looking at alternative ways of working with women once they are released.
And maybe you can paint us a bit of a picture for what the sort of social landscape is like there in Winnipeg, and why this transition is needed.
Well, in terms of this particular social co-op, the idea was really, I focused on women, so I'm not to the exclusion of men. It's just I've always worked in women's centers, so mm-hmm. in women's prisons. So women, when they're released, the women's prison right now has very short-term sentences, a lot of women on remand. They're over double their capacity of a brand new facility that was built, and for 100 women, they're well over 200 and being housed there right now. When provincial women are released, there's no real plan for them. They've had very short-term sobriety. They've sort of been on remand for a long period of time with no services and then a very short sentence and then released. And once a woman is criminalized, she has no access to the economy. And once a woman has no access to the economy, her safety is greatly compromised. And what happens is that we run into this recidivism of sexual exploitation, of addictions, of poverty, of all of these things that when people are excluded from the economy, that this happens, right? So when women the idea really was the big condition for women coming out of jail and, you know, is work, except for no one's hiring women coming out of jail. So this is where the cooperative sort of came into sort of my brain around, well, you know, women could be self-employed and they can work collectively and we could come up with programs collectively, and if this was a way through education, because that's the next big criteria for women coming out of jail, is they need education. And the beautiful part about co-ops and the structure of it is that it's integrated into those very principles.
And so were you aware of the co-op model before you met with Judith? And how did you come to know about co-ops?
Well, I'm a very socially aware sort of business person, right? So because I worked in agencies for many years, women's agencies, we've had other opportunities to have collectives or sort of the lighter version of co-ops. And the cooperative movement, I've had a lot of economic development experience. So I focus on women and money and their participation in the economy. And the co-ops just made sense. It allowed sort of communal ownership. It allowed communal participation. It allowed where your skills may not be par, you might have other people who come in with those skills that could support you within it. And that just seemed to work. It's just a natural alignment with sort of these sort of feminist values, right? Alignment with indigenous values in terms of how we work as community together and how we trade and barter.
And Judith, you said that you were traveling in Italy and visiting prison co-ops. Is there an aspect of these social co-ops that has sort of always piqued your interest and got you more involved? Or was it this trip to Italy that really turned your light on with respect to the impact of social co-ops?
Well, I've always been interested in the third sector of the economy, in the informal sector, in the commons, and in the idea of reciprocity and how that's a motivating factor for people as an alternative to a more competitive economic environment. So I went to Italy and toured prison co-ops with Anne Hoyt from Wisconsin, and we saw prison co-ops that were catering to five-star hotels. So it's the benefits were obvious to us. There were a number of them that we looked at. And the cost of control was reduced. They would never jeopardize this situation for themselves. The men who we saw in the catering co-op, they had their chef's caps and their chef's uniforms on, and they were very proud of what they did.
Mm-hmm.
We saw a bicycle co-op, a number of co-ops that were working for people, And people in the prisons were being paid at a rate equal to what they would have been paid outside the prison, very different from what we do with work in our prison.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like an option here in Winnipeg.
And so this was working inside of the prison system in Italy, as opposed to as a transitional after you get out type thing, right?
That's right. And then we went back. We were in Croatia for the co-op, International Co-op Association conferences, Bernice and I. And along with Anne Hoyt, we again toured some of the prison co-ops in Milan, a designer's co-op, in Venice, a jewelry making and cosmetics co-op, and in Forli, a recycling co-op, Gulliver. So we saw Alice Gulliver and the co-op as well in Venice. So we saw this as an opportunity to bring something like this to Winnipeg.
And they had the Alice and the Gulliver were transition co-ops. They were their model was interesting because people would be released and during the day to go work in the co-op in the community and then housed back in the prison in overnight or report back. And so they would get these work passes and whatever extensions on those. So it was their way of, and what was interesting is when they were on the inside, they were making, you know, around the €8 an hour. And then the outside, they were making €14 an hour. And they would be part of these co-ops as part of their release. So that we saw that model as really opportune ideas around social co-ops, around decarceration this particular way, how you know, we can sort of shift that that whole notion of that it's just government, you know, government run, where it's government funded, where there was self-generation of funds through these businesses, and it went to support that decarceration very specifically. And I really liked that particular model.
Yeah, it's a great model. I mean, it sounds like it's addressing some of the major issues people are facing coming out of incarceration. You're just saying education and work.
Mm-hmm.
I did want to, I'm curious if you actually have managed to start a social co-op in this sector.
Well, I can tell you one co-op that has some of the members of Eagle Women's Lodge associated with it. And we did some training in Eagle Women's Lodge a couple of years ago. Val Vint is now a member of a co-op, the designer's co-op at Nietzsche Commons in Winnipeg. And so that co-op, I think, is benefiting from her commitment to co-op. So that's one example.
I just want to go back to this notion of social co-ops for a minute, because you said, have we started them? And this is what's interesting. You know, the landscape in Manitoba with social enterprise and social co-ops, I find that they get limited in their sole purpose is employment in terms of the impact of social co-ops. Whereas when I'm talking about social co-ops, I'm actually talking about a systemic or a co-op that replaces systems or decolonizes systems like child welfare. So when I talk about social co-ops, I don't think anyone has really started social co-ops that I've seen in Manitoba. We have a lot of, you know, consumer co-ops and production co-ops, and that's wonderful, and workers' co-ops, and those are great. But in terms of an actual social co-op, I haven't really seen any. And with it, in that meaning that the sole purpose is to provide social services and that it has an economic driver that isn't just government funding, and this is the question we're exploring, is those social co-ops, how does that actually look? And we're looking at child welfare, and then if we look at how does that work into economic factors, we start exploring the whole concept of social impact bonds. So we're sort of asking all these questions ourselves. What does a social co-op actually look like? And I know, you know, Judy could probably comment on some of the work of Rostakis when he talks about social co-ops. But I don't know. Does that answer your question?
It does, and it actually gives me like 14 more questions. But I guess I too am trying to wrap my head around what this idea of a social co-op is, and I found it interesting that providing social services is not necessarily something that you can produce a profit in order to continue to run your business. Even if it's a nonprofit, like I think Community Services Co-op is kind of the nonprofit co-op model that we see a lot here in BC. I'm wondering, how do you fund a social co-op that has social mission but desire to be I guess be profitable enough to keep going. And I'm really curious what a social welfare bond is, or social impact bond.
Well, Ristakas talks a lot about relational services. So he talks about elderly people being separated when they get older and they have to go into institutions. He talks about services that are provided better by family members who come together. So this is the model that you find in northern in Italy as well. And providing these kinds of services has many advantages. Of course, Italy has a lot of support in terms of legislation that subsidizes this approach to providing social services, but they have a lot of experience in this. And Ristakas mentions cases in Quebec and cases in BC that are much more efficient because they have membership of workers who are treated more respectfully. You've got family members who are talking about passionately about what their family members need. And so there are a lot of efficiencies that arise out of these relationships that exist when you have the solidarity co-ops, the consumer, the worker, and the supporter involved in the co-op. So these are things that we see as resulting in great savings for government if the co-op principles are followed.
So just to get a little more specific and go back to the social impact bond, it's kind of a new language, isn't it, the social impact bond? It's really about investment by the private sector in public sector sort of delivery of services. They're looking for social returns on investment. And that's really where we would move this, is that when we talk about I'm going to pick on child welfare for a moment, just mm-hmm. so we can get kind of specific about the conversation in terms of social co-ops. If we use that system, you would look at this whole conversation and this exploring social impact bonds. These are investment bonds that aren't really looking for just the return on the investment to investors. They're looking at a social return on investment. And these are measures that now, whether there's all kinds of discussion and dialogue, and people sit on different sides of the fence on this, but it remains that the key piece why this would be important is because they carry with it what I call reinvestment value, meaning that if you invest through business plan in an organization and they manage that plan where they meet their targets and they reduce their costs, they can keep those savings and reinvest it in their organizations to carry out their mission. And so with that same sort of premise, in child welfare, you have a system that's legislatively funded. And you've got two parts of this system. The very first part is the system that funds children in care. And then you've got the second part that funds the system itself and the services to families. So in that, the government controls, and it's 100% funded. There is no cap. This is part of where the issues lay, is that it's sort of this exponential dollar amount that it's reactionary dollars. And the way the system in Manitoba was devolved very specifically was into four authorities. And what had happened in this devolution was the government passed the liability of that legislation to First Nations, Métis, and Inuit, exactly the same policies, and they said, you go run it. But they didn't really transfer the resources to actually run the system, to which they created this legislation and policy. And so they converted all of the funding into these headcount funding, both federally and provincially, in either jurisdiction, whether it was on reserve or not, had converted all the funding to headcount funding. Now, there's all kinds of driving factors for that, And, you know, some would argue it would provide response. Others says it just feeds the system. It becomes an economy. Truth to that, because there's no, as Manitoba's demonstrated, in fact, our system has done nothing but has grown. And, in fact, it's actually outgrown the natural birth rate in Manitoba, the apprehension rate, which frightens me a lot. Right?
Yeah, that's terrifying.
Yeah, isn't that? And you have communities in care, rural communities in and remote communities, where 60% of the communities in care. And they're in care not because there's neglect, but because they have other needs. They have, you know, children with special service needs. They need to go into care in order to access these services. So we have all of these uses and inefficiencies. And so what I actually propose, and what I would, when I propose social co-ops, is that we measure the economic investment or the economic driver by going through social impact bonds or looking at alternative ways to fund, that it doesn't have to come through just government resources, that there are social impact bonds, that that the return is actually the investment on social change within communities. And that's what, when we look at the language of social co-ops, is that we need to talk about, does that include social impact bonds? Is that an investment? Is that a way to have an economic driver? We see in Italy they've created businesses and they've created these partnerships where you could have businesses in the community where people work and belong to, and they could be home care, they could be child care, they could be all these sort of services, right, along with social impact bonds or along with investment bonds or along with other ways of funding. So I would see it as actually a dual stream. I would see it as much like Italy, where they provided, say, vulnerable worker wages to organizations that employ people coming from jail and in their co-ops, right? So there are ways to invest. So I would say there's not just one brushstroke, you know, they have to go and do this, but we have already seen other models of this that we could bring together under that context.
And so does Canada have social impact bonds today?
Well, you know, it's so early on the lips of so many people, right? Mm. And so this is why we're exploring this notion, because it pulls in that private sector, those people to finance this, right? And the return on investment isn't the dollar value they're looking for, right? They're looking for a social impact. They're looking to, you have these corporate citizens who they fund this, they fund that, but this is targeted funding with targeted impact, with targeted populations that we already know we're working with, and these are our families and our systems, right?
Yeah, and absolutely, and it seems like a quantified agreement about targets with money attached to it, and in a way that we don't really see articulated that well.
Well, we shift the value to humans. Mm-hmm. Now, isn't that a cooperative value, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we shift the value of that investment from dollars, and we talk about the multi-millions of dollars we put into the system, we're not really talking about the social impacts of the system, are we, right?
Mm.
So once we change that language to those measures, I just feel like this is the opportune time to have this conversation, because the one piece that's so important in the co-oping of social services is that we're decolonizing that system. In all the recommendations in Manitoba, they talk about putting services in communities' hands, right?
Mm-hmm.
That people have a voice, that you have savings, that you have training, that you have all of these things. Now, the system has remained the same. All it has changed is the pressures on workers, the additional training, the additional resources needed. You could literally reinvest all the resources that are currently out there, probably save $100 million, by co-oping, by moving this into, you know, maybe centralized procurement, right? Having the purchasing power, much like the Métis did with their in their system, right? They came out with this entire purchasing power. So there's ways to have different levels of co-op within the social services realm. But what it does is it flattens the hierarchy. It encompasses so many of the recommendations we've seen in the Truth and Reconciliation Report, we've seen in the Phoenix Sinclair Inquiry, that what's not happened is the actual decolonization of the actual administrative system. Hmm. In fact, it's the same governmental system, from when I was a kid in care, right? It's the same system. It hasn't changed.
Hmm.
And so we keep trying to implement, this decolonized system, yet it's in a colonized system, right? How do you change that? And that's where the whole notion of co-ops come in. and shifting that value of just dollars, shifting to the value of people and the value of the outcome.
We're speaking with Bernice Sear and Judith Harris. They are community activists and community development leaders in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and we're speaking about their paper, Social Services and the Co-op Option for Indigenous Communities. You're listening to Vancouver Co-op Radio. This is CFRO 100.5 FM in Vancouver, and you can listen live online at cooperadio.org. This is Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. Really interesting subject matter tonight here on social cooperatives. Hope you're enjoying it. We're going to take a short musical break with War Party and Feeling Reserved here on Vancouver Co-op Radio.
As I look into your eyes, I realize that we're living out the white man's lies. There was no compromise, just deceit, as I faced the defeat that was put here long before me. At times I find it hard to accept. I ask God, is this a test? Is this really all we have left? Cause my son's life is just getting started, and life is seeming harder, just to try stay above the water. I remember the days of way back when we had no gang fights, we had no crack pipes, and brothers got along in the families. What the hell went wrong with the families? My reservation.
I'm feeling the pain, the strain on my mental weighs heavy. Genocide makes me live my native life deadly. I hope you get me, if you don't, let it marinate. The mind state of my people, we try to set that straight. We never brought residential schools to this place. We never brought alcoholic fluid to our tastes. We would never go and try change you. What you did to my descendants changed the elders' lives too. And all the time you knew, now we feeling reserved, living disturbed, living a life, we never deserved. The native way of thinking ain't the way of the old. It's time to look towards the future, let our story unfold.
I'm feeling reserved, man, the time living. I gotta do with this mic I was given to try to get by, no word of a lie. We gotta try to restore pride. I'm feeling reserved, man, the time living. I gotta do with this mic I was given to try to get by, no word of a lie. We gotta try to restore pride.
Reservations only, no need to wait for seeding. Natives continue bleeding, the circle just keeps repeating. This feeling filling the void, explore the people changing. It's why I turn the tables like time, turning the page and going against the grain. Engaged in hell throughout the day, and no way it's simple or plain. Need to maintain through these pains, taking these short ends, making on cause and acrylic abortion. It all costs so all the real can gain applause. Reserves relentless, yo, it's what I gotta contend with. Sundance the rest demented, genuine arsenal lessons from beneath the ground sentence to bless the four elements. This mic, this light, this rest, this life I represent my residence.
Sweet grace, how music lets my mind take flight. Res life, my life, living awake of sleepless nights. Feed my eyes colorblind, catch a glimpse of baby sight. Realize there's more to see than all this rock round me. Grant this girl a beat and let my soul run free. Amidst a plague of war, there ain't no way I'd rather be. One love for my people, UNITE. Instead of feeling reserved, my reserve feel
I'm
me.
I'm feeling reserved, man, the time living. I gotta do with this mic I was given to try to get by, no word of a lie. We gotta try to restore pride.
I'm feeling reserved, man, the time living. I gotta do with this mic I was given to try to get by, no word of a lie. We gotta try to restore pride. I'm feeling reserved, man, the time living. I gotta do with this mic I was given to try to get by, no word of a lie. We gotta try to restore pride.
CFRO 100.5 FM, Vancouver Cooperative Radio. You don't have to like us, but at least we know who we are. So we're back here on Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. That was War Party from Alberta with their song Feeling Reserved. And tonight our guests are Bernice Sear and Judith Harris, and we are talking about social services and the cooperative option for Indigenous communities. Judith and Bernice are researchers, cooperative researchers, and community development leaders in Winnipeg, Manitoba. we're going to pick up our conversation again here. And we'll be talking about interesting topics of decolonization of the child and family services and other social systems, the justice system, education systems, looking at a cooperative model. What might this look like? Flattening the hierarchy, putting the power into people's hands. Imagine these systems. If people in these systems had a vote, it would be such a different system. It's a re-administrating a system to meet the needs of the members. So interesting topics coming up. I hope you enjoy it. This is Bernice Sear and Judith Harris on Vancouver Co-op Radio.
Have you talked to other co-ops in your area about this? I know specifically we've interviewed Norwest Co-op here, an amazing model, really successful. And I'm curious, when you're talking about a lot of the social impact bonds, I'm thinking, like, I wonder if like Norwest would be a candidate for that type of investment as well.
I think that Norwest is a really good example of a cooperative approach to providing health services, clearly. And they're very much involved at the grassroots. I've had a number of students who've been interns there. And, you know, I've seen what they do. They are challenging traditional approaches to delivery of services in low-income areas. And so I think you're right. That is a very good example. I would say that Nietzsche Foods is trying to initiate a different kind of model, more of a solidarity approach with members represented on the board, worker members and supporter members, as well as consumer members. And in a business area that's very challenging, groceries, it's a very challenging business environment for them. So they're working very hard on establishing an alternative approach as well. So I think there are other co-ops in the area across Canada that are very much on side with this approach and the social co-op approach.
So your paper that you presented at CASC is called Social Services and the Co-op Option for Indigenous Communities: Convergence with Traditional Values and Practice. And I wanted to get a sense of that connection that you see between traditional values and practice and the co-op model. You lay it out in your paper, but I'm wondering if you can kind of articulate that for our listeners.
Yes, I think Lou Hammond and Ian McPherson have looked at that convergence and have seen that as a very appropriate model, the co-op model. They see that there are some tensions as well in terms of rural communities and the Indian Act, land ownership, et cetera. But we've spoken to a number of people about how the co-op principles converge with traditional principles. And so one of the things that we've examined, and Cindy Blackstock has also introduced some interesting ideas about how we change child and family services in order to decolonize that system. And she's making the point that we have to look at the macro level and the micro level. She talks about how the system has to be placed in a cultural context, how we have to be aware of what Terry Cross calls relational worldviews. And so we looked at the medicine wheel, for example, and we saw a clear connection between the seven gifts that are identified in Ojibwe traditions and other First Nations traditions and the co-op principles. So, for example, we could see a clear connection between respect and community, between truth and democracy, between humility and cooperation, honesty and participation, courage and autonomy, wisdom and education, identity and love. So in our paper, we're exploring, and other people are exploring those connections between the different values in these two views of economy and provision of services.
When you're talking about decolonizing the systems here, you've spoken specifically around the child welfare system. Is this something that you can see that could be applied to a lot of different facets to assist in this process of decolonization?
Well, yes. It's the whole notion of the decolonizing the actual system administration, whether it's an educational system, whether it's a justice system, a children's system. The beautiful part of this is that it flattens the hierarchy, right?
Mm-hmm.
It puts the membership in the consumer or the person who's accessing those services' hands, right? They get a vote. Now, could you imagine if the prison systems or correction systems or the child welfare systems, if every person who accessed their services, who worked in the services, who were part of the service or a file was open, had a vote? Like, we would see a very different system, right?
Mm-hmm.
We'd see something very different. And so it's something that the part about co-ops is that if you have silos right now in the systems we see, for instance, if I'm a child in Manitoba and I go into care, I'm dealing with the education system, the health system, the CFS system, right? If I have any medical needs, I'm now in a health system. None of these converge together, right? None of them... they don't share information. You have to go through all kinds of SIPA. You have to go through all kinds of releases of information in order to access service for the same child. Whereas this whole notion of co-oping systems, if you could imagine children's systems being co-oped where you would access as a child, you'd be able to access everything under that premise, right? It's readministering the system to meet the needs of its members as opposed to having each individual sort of navigate through a system that doesn't quite meet their needs, and then they're in a different system. So in actuality, we've built five different systems to address the same child. So on the very macro level, yes, there are all kinds of ways to bring systems together under this umbrella. And the beautiful part is if you looked at even legislation, that once the government could support legislation around co-oping a particular children's co-op that would address children's services, you'd be able to bring all those services underneath that same legislative body or that same legal organization known as co-op, correct? And so there's all kinds of efficiencies that come from this. So when you build the systems together, you actually would reduce the silos. You would flatten the hierarchy. You would put the votes in people's hands. You would invest in training. You would bring it away from this whole notion of the government ownership and funding. And these are all sort of ideas and knowledge around how do we decolonize systems, right? So far, we've gotten as far as saying, well, services need to be Aboriginal focused. Well, that's not decolonizing the system. That's delivering services, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this needs to happen not just in all kinds of systems that have the same hierarchy.
I'm curious, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's report came out over a year ago. Have you seen any steps forward in Winnipeg, in your area, in your communities, to try and address the report's findings?
Yes, actually, you know, the work we're doing is all based on these reports. All the recommendations are based on this report. You know, interestingly enough, child welfare in Manitoba is very, very governed by those recommendations. So it's in the justice systems. And the mandate of the government is there's a public accounts committee that they'll have to report their progress to, right? And so our government, whether NDP, Conservative, our government has been good in the last 10 years on making progress on whether it's the Phoenix and Clare report, the Truth Reconciliation. There was a report actually in 2015 where they did consult with community and it was presented to the minister. So there's a lot of people who have ideas and responses to the recommendations, but it's still in its very early stages. I mean, there's some, you know, some of these recommendations have already been adopted, but it really boils down to what feels like more recommendations on already taxed systems that already are sort of thin, and some of the calls to action feel like, for many of these systems, maybe added resources, where what we're saying is if you co-op, you could probably reduce your administrative costs greatly by sharing resources and by pooling resources and be able to reinvest that money into the direct services that are needed to carry out these recommendations, because as good as the recommendations are, the government here is strapped. We, you know, our child welfare system, much like the prison that I just described of having double their capacity, our child welfare system is just we can't take any more kids into care. Okay, we actually have nowhere else to put them. They're going into hotels, right? So we're at this crisis point where something has to change. You can't just cut services, right, to save some money. So where do you take the money? How do you reinvest? Where does this come from? We have to have this whole, we have to have the whole conversation about breaking down the structure of these systems that they, like I said, they passed on to the First Nations, Métis and Inuit, and said, here's the legislation we want you to govern. We'll give you half the money. We'll manage the other half. But there's no incentive to save money. There's no incentive to redirect that money, because it's all very reactionary and it's all very thin to begin with. So recommendations in many of these systems will happen in terms of the service delivery, and it's going to be put on the backs of workers to figure it out, right, to report back. Will the systems change? I don't know. I don't see that on any, in fact, in any of the reports I've seen myself, I actually don't see any of that being discussed. I don't see the, you know, the funding model being reorganized. I don't see that. You know, we still have the Manitoba government, Cindy Blackstock talks about this, clawing back. They're clawing back the child tax, the universal child tax benefit that goes to children. They claw that back from their kids in care in order to fund their system. This is those children's money, right? So other jurisdictions are taking that money and they're investing it into RESPs for those children in their care, right? So are they following through? I would say at the very early stages, I feel like the people who've been the most responsive, to be honest with you, has been community organizations. The most responsive.
400 plus volunteers bringing voice to Vancouver since 1975. Vancouver Co-op Radio. CFRO 100.5 FM.
Yeah,
so that was pretty harsh contrast there. You're listening to Vancouver Co-op Radio. This is Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. Tonight we're talking with Bernice Sear and Judith Harris, cooperative researchers and community development leaders in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Their paper is Social Services and the Co-op Option for Indigenous Communities. We've been talking about the child welfare system in crisis in Manitoba, some really interesting conversation around addressing these issues. One of the figures that came up that was quite shocking to me was the number of children going into care in Manitoba, the number of Aboriginal children going into care in Manitoba is actually higher than the birth rate for Aboriginal children, which is a pretty shocking statistic to hear about. We're going to hear the last part of the interview now, where we focus on converting to a new model for social services. How does this look? What does it take? How do we look at converting to a new model for social services from within an existing bureaucratic system? You're listening to Vancouver Co-op Radio. This is Each for All, the Cooperative Connection.
Also, picture in my mind, what does that transition look like if we were to be able to develop social co-ops to serve communities and better in these different sectors? How does that model work in conjunction with an existing bureaucratic system?
Manitoba has also already identified four authorities that are attempting to, and in an attempt to decentralize
Child and Family Services to the local level, they've maintained financial control over those four authorities. So there is still concern about evaluating those systems and determining how effective those systems are. But still, the funding is being held by the province. So that is a limitation on control at the local level. I know that Lou Hammond Kettleson has looked at the challenges for co-ops. And one of the challenges is that Aboriginal development corporations, who are central to economic development and supply of services, has not promoted the co-op model. Our feeling is that the same arguments that can be put forward about the savings that are to be realized if we put forward a social co-op model, social impact bond model to the province, those same arguments are there for Aboriginal development corporations as well. And with the clear convergence of values, we believe that northern communities would be on side with this more holistic approach to the delivery of services.
Yeah, so, interesting, because you can't really have an autonomous co-op if all of its funds are being held by the government.
And that's why social impact bonds become so critical, mm-hmm. right? This conversation needs to happen, because it has to be funded in a much different way. So when you I'm just going to go back to the question around, you know, so how does this happen? How do you roll this out? Well, it starts certainly with, you know, we start with the recommendations, because that's where the work plan's managed, right? Because that's the whole, we have to meet those. So we start with those. Now, the big piece is you have to look at the most critical elements and areas. So right now, rural and remote communities who lack services would be the ideal place to start, because then you can cluster those co-ops and those services there. You can look at them within their environment, and you're able to sort of work out on smaller scales, right? sort of the cluster of those services and development of that co-op. And then as you go from rural and remote, you would head then into more urban centers, because that's the natural stream right now of those services. They usually start with intake that happens in an urban center, and then, you know, they go through the system from there. There are ways you can stage it in. It would be something that I could see the government adopting principles as you go through. I can't see them just adopting it all and saying, yeah, let's co-op and circle dance and hold hands. I don't think that's going to happen, right? There should be natural tensions. We should question those systems. We should look at how do we apply each of these principles in terms of being cooperative, right?
Mm-hmm.
Being able to develop policy, because legislation ultimately protects children and child welfare. The legislation has to be upheld. So within that legislation, we have regulations. How do we start writing policy that we can deliver in terms of keeping children safe? How do we cluster the services? Because when we get down to the administration of it, that's not really... the administration is something that was never really, you know, sort of regulated in terms of, for instance, how big of an office do you need? How many workers do you know? All those kinds of things only came in with a funding model. It came in by dollars as opposed to by policy. And every time we bring in things like that, what happens is that it's always driven by the dollars. So this is something that would have to start through policy, right? And then once you start sort of in a smaller scale, you can then expand out those cluster models. So ideally, that's how I would see it rolling out in Manitoba.
We are coming to the end of our time here. I did want to ask you about CASC, about the Canadian Association for Studies in Cooperation. You presented your paper there, and I'm curious what the experience is working with CASC. What do you get out of it?
Well, CASC brings together a group of people, both practitioners and educators, in the field of cooperatives. So it's a wonderful gathering of diverse people. I'm sure you've seen this, Robin,
mm-hmm.
year after year. And so we had this year we had a wonderful panel and session on Indigenous co-ops and values, and the response in the audience was very positive. And we had a presentation by Isabel Finley on co-ops and education. And so CASC is a very important organization for bringing people together across the country to promote the idea of cooperatives. And increasingly, there is more coordination of promotion of education on co-ops. We have a chair in co-op studies here at University of Winnipeg. And so these initiatives are really being supported by people who attend the CASC conferences, people working in universities across the country, and people who are well connected with the international community as well.
Awesome. And Bernice, did you attend CASC as well?
I couldn't make it to the Calgary one. I did. I was in Croatia presenting as well.
Oh, wow.
And we're looking at this whole piece around women coming out of jail and exploring this school, because we are trying to build this learners co-op and have this whole piece come through an academic co-op to decarcerate women.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to wrap it up, but I would love to hear more about that in the future as stuff gets rolling.
Well, we'll let you know, because we're hopefully going to present to the minister, and hopefully we'll be one of those social impact bonds that we're able to have this whole thing going ahead.
Amazing. Well, thank you, Bernice, and thank you, Judith. This has been really interesting, not a subject we've ever covered here on Each for All before. This has the potential for so much impact. It's very exciting stuff.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity, Robin.
So that was Bernice Sear and Judith Harris. They are cooperative researchers and community development leaders from Winnipeg, Manitoba. And that's it for us here on Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. If you would like to hear the show again or share with a friend, we'll have it up on our website shortly at eachforall.coop. Our guests next week, we're very happy to have a new person to join us for co-op check-ins. We're going to have Heather Pritchard. She is the Farm Program Manager for Farm Folk City Folk. It's an agricultural co-op, and she'll be sharing with us an idea of what's going on in the agricultural co-op sector here in British Columbia. We'll also have Chris Nichols, our resident worker co-op expert and teacher at Groundswell, as well Vanessa Hammond, the executive director of the Healthcare Co-ops Federation of Canada. They'll be our guests next week here on Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. You're, of course, listening to Vancouver Co-op Radio. This is your radio station. You can always listen live online at cooperadio.org and become a member if you're not one. If you have any ideas for a show, you can email us at ideas@eachforall.coop, and you can follow us on Twitter at @eachforall. Have a cooperative evening. We'll see you next week. This is a little Sam Roberts with The Canadian Dream.